Only accumulated detritus.
So our colleague Christer Bigfoot from Stockholm University will respond to David Roden's paper. And David Roden, of course, is from Oxford University.
Thank you. And thanks a lot for inviting me. I should say that I'm not an ethics of war person. I'm, I guess, more ethics person. And I'm not an expert on authority, but I guess I know a bit about wrongdoing. So that's what I'm not an expert on wrongdoing, but I know a bit. And so I'm going to focus on that part of the paper, but also say a little bit about the applications to ethics of war towards the end. So just to give you the overall structure, as I take it, of the paper. So first of all, Roden's aim of the paper is to formulate a viable requirement of authority that is consistent with a revisionist just war theory. And what is this requirement? Well, there's sort of slightly different formulations in the paper, but the first formulation on page 3 is accordingly, acts of wars are fully permissible only when undertaken by an authority. And what's an authority? Well, there are slightly different formulations here too, but on page 3, which is the first official formulation, we have it, quote, an authority has sufficient epistemic and deliberative competence and is situated as far as reasonably possible to be subject to no countervailing reasons beyond reasons of legal or moral justice, end of quote. So the challenge, as I take it for you in this paper then, is to try to sort out this inconsistent triad. You don't put it in this way, but I've sort of set it up in this way. So you have three claims that look pretty plausible, but they can't be combined. And the first claim is then that acts of war are coordinated exercises of individual acts of self-defense, which is part of the revisionist just war theory, as you know very well. The second claim is sort of an intuitive claim, I guess, that individual acts of self-defense are not subject to requirement of authority. And thirdly, the third claim, acts of war are subject to a requirement of authority. So here we have an inconsistent triad, and we have to give up at least one of the claims. And Roden wants to accept the first claim, revisionist just war theory, and the third claim, that acts of war are subject to requirements of authority. So he has to then reject the second claim, which was the claim that individual acts of self-defense are not subject to a requirement of authority. So he's going to argue that, in fact, even individual acts of self-defense are subject to a requirement of authority. So how does he then reject this claim too? Well, roughly speaking, I'll come back to some of the details later on, he's arguing for the rejection of the second claim by saying that acts of self-defense are subject to a requirement of authority, for such acts are wrong in what he calls a determination relative sense, if they are based on a defective process of determination. So if these actions are based on this defective process of determination to act, then they are wrong in this special sense, namely determination relative sense. And the process is defective if the agent is not an authority in the sense I just described, namely lacks sufficient epistemic or deliberative competence or is subject to countervailing reasons. So that's very quick summary, and not I'm not getting into some of the details and some of the qualifications you gave. So this is quite a rough summary, but I think it might be enough. And I'll now move on to look at more of the crucial concepts and assumptions in your argument against the second claim. One comment, though, before I move on, and if there's a comment I will come back to, actually, is that if you look at the formulation of the requirement on page 3, it's in terms of fully permissible. And it's not so clear what fully permissible means, right? I mean, usually, we talk about permissible, impermissible. But what is fully permissible? Because it suggests that permissibility comes in degrees. You can have more of permissibility or less of permissibility. And for many, I guess that's a quite an unusual concept, and we need to be at least need to get a grip on that kind of concept. Some kind of guidance is needed. So I will come back to a possible suggestion on how to understand this notion of fully permissible. Another comment here, I guess, is that it looks like, at least prima facie, that something can be fully permissible, and still not doing it can also be fully permissible. So all my actions, available actions, can be fully permissible, I guess. But then, of course, there's no requirement. So in order to have a requirement, it can't just be enough to show that an action is fully permissible. It has to be the only, I guess, fully permissible action, something like that. So something more has to be added in order to get a requirement of authority. It can't just be that in order to have fully permissible action, you need to be undertaken by an authority, because that's just making it fully permissible and not a requirement. But I will come back to the notion of fully permissible later on. So that was just the overall structure of the summary of the paper, very quick summary. And then the argument now against premise two. So there's a very crucial concept here, which I just mentioned, and the determination relative wrongness. So it's quite a big part of the essay is actually focused on trying to explain what that is and show why it's important, this argument. First of all, I guess, Rodin does accept Derek Parfit's idea that morally wrong is actually radically ambiguous. So you have, for instance, according to Parfit himself, you have ordinary sense of wrongness, moral wrongness, fact relative sense of moral wrongness, evidence relative sense of wrongness, and belief relative sense of wrongness. And Parfit himself defines all these senses in terms of ordinary sense of moral wrongness, so that seemed to be some kind of primitive, and then the rest is defined in terms of that. So, as I understand Rodin, he accepts that these are legitimate sort of senses of moral wrongness, but he wants to add to this list of senses of moral wrongness yet another kind, namely determination relative sense of wrongness. This is quite a radical view, I would have thought, because it's not radical to say that wrongness is radically ambiguous, because we know that wrongness, the term wrong, can be used in so many different contexts. You can talk about the wrong turn, you can talk about the wrong answer, you can talk about the wrong person, and so on. That's true. So we have a lot of, for instance, non-moral usages of wrong. And wrong can be attached to actions or agents or situations even. So the claim is that moral wrongness as ascribed to actions is radically ambiguous, and that's a more of a controversial view, I would say. So Rodin is not happy with the Parfitian list. You want to add this determination relative sense as well, because you think you need that in order to explain why these acts of individual acts of self-defense cannot be fully permissible unless they're undertaken by an authority. And an act is wrong in this determination relative sense just in case it's the result of a defective process of determining how to act, and at least a sufficient condition for defective process of determination of to act is the following. Here's a quote from page 6. It fails to align action with what is permissible in a fact-relative or evidence-relative sense in a sufficiently reliable way. So if that condition holds, then that's a sufficient condition for the process to be defective. And then Rodin here says again that an act is not fully morally right if it's based on a process that is defective in this sense. So again, here you see the notion of fully coming in, not to permissibility, but to moral rightness here. So that's the explanation of what this determination relative sense is. Now, I have a few questions or / objections. So the one question, I guess, is about the usage you make of this determination relative sense of wrongness. You want to use it to explain our intuition concerning certain situations, examples in the paper. But I wasn't so convinced that that's the best or the only, at least the only plausible way to understand what's going on in these examples. So at least there are these alternative ways to understand what's going on. So for instance, instead of sort of positing yet another sense of moral wrongness, I think you could, for instance, say that it is wrong to perform an action X on the basis of a defective process of reasoning. And what's the object of assessment is that whole thing, action plus process, right? That whole thing. It's wrong to perform X on the basis of defective process of reasoning. That's the whole thing. Well, performing X might be right, still, but performing X on the basis of the process might be still be wrong. Right? So it's changing the object of assessment, still actions, I guess, but it's action plus process or action minus process, and you can have different assessment of the act on its own and the act plus the process. And I guess it ties into some of the examples given earlier. If you save a child on the basis of a process of deliberation, you want to be very famous and get a lot of money, you might say the saving of the child is morally right, morally required even, but saving the child on the basis of this is not right, or not as right as the action itself. So that's an issue, right? So whether at least some of these examples you're putting forward could be better understood even in terms of attaching wrongness to this thick thing, action plus the process. Another alternative, of course, is to assign rightness not to the action at all, or action plus process, but actually to the agent. So it's the agent that's the wrong kind of person if he or she performs actions on the basis of such processes. So he lacks a virtue, you could say. He's not fully virtuous. It's pretty plausible to say that one virtue is actually to reliably produce right actions, and he lacks that kind of virtue. So, and that makes the agent a wrong kind of person to some extent. So that's another option. You have a comment on that later on, so I'll come back to that. Another approach is not to look at the objects of assessment, but to look at the different kinds of assessment of the same object, right? So instead of sort of having moral rightness, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and so on, you have moral rightness, and then you have morally good action or fully virtuous action. So you have other kinds of assessments, evaluative assessments, rather than deontic assessments. So you could say, for instance, if the action is based on this kind of defective process or deliberation, it's not fully virtuous. It's not morally good. It's not reflecting well on the agent as a virtuous agent, because it lacks a virtue. And again, we have example. I think we discussed some of these before. I mean, back to the trolleys. If I turn right and kill the one guy rather than the five, might be permissible, I think, even though my motivation might be a hatred towards the one. So I'm definitely not a virtuous person. And also, it might be wrong, perhaps, to perform an action on the basis of such a hatred, but the action itself might possibly be the only one permissible. It's the only one permissible in the case either turn right, turn left. It's actually permissible to turn right rather than turn left. And also the example of saving a child, you could say that that's morally permissible, even though your motivation is to gain fame and financial gain and so on. But the action itself is not fully virtuous, because it's not expressing a virtue, because you lack a virtue. You lack a certain virtue. And a comment here, again, then, is that the fully popped up again, right? You remember he said that an action is not fully morally right if it's based on the process of defective deliberation. And then, what does fully right and fully permissible, we saw that earlier, mean? Well, because remember now he's been talking about different senses, right? The fact relative, evidence relative, determination relative, belief relative. So that should be applied to permissibility too, I guess. Permissible in what sense? Fully permissible in what sense? Fully right in what sense? And in fact, through that essay, you don't see any qualifications of the notions of fully right or fully permissible. It's only right that's morally right that's relativized. You won't wonder why. Why is that? What's happening here? So one interpretation of this would be that what you have in mind is that you sort of have not going to be in a shorter case, I promise, but it's rather that you have all these different notions of rightness relative to the fact relative, you have the belief relative,
You have the evidence relative or the determination relative, and there's other relative notions of rightness. And then to be fully right, or fully permissible, would be to be right in all these senses. Right. So if you take away one sense, we have an action that's factually right, so to speak, belief relative right, and evidently right, then it lacks the determination relative rightness, it's not fully right. That would be one idea. And that seems to be perfectly consistent and the story to be told. And then we have an understanding of what fully right means. But my one concern here is that you might think that do we need all these senses of rightness in order to just explain what's going on here? Couldn't we just think about there are certain facts that makes something right in the perfect sense of being a fact relative right, some fact, and there's something about the beliefs that makes it right in the belief relative sense, and so on, for evidence and determination and what have we. And then basically skip these senses, right, and skip the fully. It's just overall right here, and what we have here is just sort of various right makers, right? And right makers for rightness unqualified, no relative this and that. So that the facts provide some reason or some right maker that believes in another, true belief perhaps, is another right maker, evidence, a third, and so on, and determination is another. And then we don't have to take on this quite controversial view that moral rightness is this radical, ambiguous term. And still, I think we can capture some of what you want to capture. So that's a sort of friendly suggestion to cut the middleman, so to speak. Forget about the relative rightness and go right from the facts to the overall rightness, and then you have these various different right makers. Of course, you might not be happy to treat them as right makers, but I think that you can have that discussion as well. In fact, I'm not sure all of these are seen as right makers, but that's another. So I'm trying to sort of step in your shoes now, try to see it from your perspective. And then you would have no need to posit this sort of radical ambiguity of moral rightness. I think you have a response to this, why you don't like this, and I will come back to that. You do consider the objection to that, but why not sort of assign rightness wrongness to the agent? And you think that's not a good option. And what you say here puzzled me a little bit, because you say that the relevant wrong maker here is acting with a process of determination that is unreliable, it's page 8, and acting this way is distinct from just having, but not acting on such a process. That's fine. I think I'm a defender of the view that it's the agent that is a wrong kind of person rather than the action being wrong. I can, of course, accept that. I can accept there is a difference between, on the one hand, acting on the basis of such a determined process and just going through the process but not acting on it. I guess it's worse in some respect to both go through the process and act on it, right? So I don't think that sort of is an answer to the objection. I mean, the idea was that why not assign rightness wrongs to the agent, and this sort of reply seems to be something they can just accept. Yeah, sure. We make a distinction between acting on the process and it's worse. You make a worse person if you not just have the process or going through the process, but also act on it. Then Rodin goes, it doesn't stop here and say that determination relative sense of wrongness is sort of explained in terms of based on defective process of reasoning. You also give a substantive explanation of why being based on defective process of determination is something morally wrong. And here you give two explanations. One is that these actions that are based on this defective process of determination involve knowingly imposing moral risks on others that may be morally excessive. And secondly, they also involve treating others unfairly by basing one's actions towards them on a process that does not reliably generate right actions. And here again, one might think, why not cut the chase here and just say, well, I'm going to treat these two things as two wrong makers. So one wrong maker is knowingly imposing more risks on others, that may be more excessive,
Another wrong maker is to treating others unfairly by basing one's actions towards them on a process that does not reliably generate actions. So that's just treating them as normal wrong makers, and you have just one unqualified wrongness to talk about. But here I think you do have an answer, and the idea I think is that, well, it sounds pretty strange, right? If, say, it's wrong to risk acting wrongly towards someone, if that means it's overall wrong to risk acting overall wrongly towards someone. It looks like some kind of circularity here. And therefore, I think what you have in mind, Rod, you should read this in the following way. It's wrong, in a determination and relative sense, to risk acting wrongly, in a fact-relative sense, or evidence-relative sense, towards someone. Similarly, when it comes to it's wrong to treat others unfairly by basing one's actions towards them in a process that does not reliably generate right actions, you might read that as it's wrong in a determination relative sense to treat others unfairly by basing one's action towards them on a process that does not reliably generate actions that are right in a fact relative or evidence relative sense. You have different senses then attached to these different occurrences of right and wrong. Well, that's one way to sort of avoid this strange, perhaps possible circularity. But another way, of course, would be to say that you have different pro tanto reasons, right, for wrongness. So one pro tanto wrongness has to do with the harming someone, perhaps. Another pro tanto wrongness has to do with the fact that you're risking a certain moral wrong, particular moral wrong, like harming someone. So that can be another pro tanto wrong. And so that's going for this picture sketch earlier. You look at the facts and see them as pro tanto wrong makers, and you don't need to posit this sort of extra sense of wrongness. Another way to go, which I can personally, I guess, is more excited about or is attracted to, is that you think about this wrongness claim as having sort of wide scope. So it's the idea is that it's wrong to, and here comes what's wrong, do X while knowing that X imposes a moral risk. That's what's wrong. And similarly, it's wrong to treat others unfairly by basing one's actions towards them on a process that does not reliably generate actions that are right. So here you have sort of wrongness taking a wide scope over this whole sort of complex state of affairs. And that would avoid the circularity because it's wrongness of actions and wrongness of these bigger things. And they seem to be consistent to have these two different objects of assessment, deontic assessment. So that's the sort of two suggestions. One suggestion was go for the pro tanto sort of model, which I introduced earlier. Another one, which more departs from your original views, is to sort of to go for the wide scoping idea. So the last bit here is about the application to ethics of war. But before I should say something about self-defense as well. So yeah, quickly, 5 minutes, right?
Yeah,
fine.
We'll go with 30.
Yeah.
It's always
30. Yeah, 5 minutes. Yeah. And you say that agents who face an imminent threat are not required to wait for the determination of an impartial body before acting in self-defense. That's page 12. And that's the sort of the challenge here, right? We have that intuition. But you say that doesn't show that self-defense does not require authority for, and here you say, first of all, in a case of imminent threat, it is practically impossible to seek such determination. So the requirement doesn't sort of get a grip there because it's not possible to follow it, I guess. And then in the case of non-imminent threat, it is practically possible, and thus you have, as you say, a clear obligation to resort to authority before acting. That's page 13. So my comment here is that, first of all, in the second case, where you have a non-imminent threat, I don't think it's so clear that you have an obligation to seek resort to authority. Because note that resorting to an authority, an external authority body, is an action itself that can make it much less likely that you will successfully defend yourself. Here I have a silly example. Sending a message to the authority, because you want to communicate them about whether you're justified in doing what you're planning to do, that act itself might, of course, show your enemy where you're located, right? So it's much less likely to defend yourself because you show them basically where you are. So it can't just be perhaps a reason, potential reason or potential obligation, but not just overall. It can't be overall obligation, I think. And secondly here, which process of determination matters here? Because notice you have the agent who's thinking about individual act of self-defense. You have an external body, authority, which will think about it and decide something or whatever. So there are two processes of determination. First is the individual agent thinking about, what should I do? Should I resort to an authority? And their motivation for that might be something really defective. Right? It might be some kind of servility or some kind of strange views about the authority being like godlike or completely mistaken, whatever, incompetently deliberate about. So it's not a well-grounded view at all. Whereas perhaps the authority might, if they get this sort of question about whether it's permissible to defend yourself in this case, might come up with a pretty impartial answer. The first process was actually deeply defective, and you might wonder, should we look at only one of these processes or both processes, and how should we weigh the fact that the first process was pretty defective and the other one was not defective? If you look at the output, of course, is an action, the self-defense action, or not the self-defense action, but it goes through two processes of determination to get to that action. Okay, at the very end, you say that there might not be any authoritative bodies to resort to before acting, and there you claim that we might have reason to create such bodies. And you also add that even if we can't do it immediately, we can take some important steps to create these truly authoritative bodies. But then, of course, again, we need to then think about what does it mean for the sort of individual, the group that is considering violent self-defense, even in the case of non-imminent threat. It's not like a threat is coming today or so, because they might have to then wait for this authoritative body to be created, and they can't wait for that. And secondly, taking even smaller steps towards authoritative ideal can itself be, of course, quite risky in some situations. In fact, both fact relatively and evidence relatively wrong. And then, in fact, you sort of very difficult to see how you can show that you should even take any steps. And at least you have to show that you are in your own sort of favored senses, evidence and fact relatively senses are permitted to take these steps. Okay, that's it.
Excellent. Great. So first of all, thank you so much, Chris, though. Wonderful set of very, very helpful comments. Just before I say a few very brief words about that, I'd just like to say on behalf of ELAC, what an amazingly wonderful couple of days this has been. I think the papers have been superb. The comments have all been absolutely wonderful, particularly from the respondents, but also the discussion as well. And also just to say that if you can bear with us for a tiny bit longer after this session ends, we'd like to just spend 5 or 10 minutes to think a little bit about next year and what we might like to do in that context there. So if you're able to hang around for a few more minutes after we end, that would be great. So just a couple of thoughts and reflections on what I think were incredibly helpful comments. So I guess the first one is that I take it that the superstructure of my argument, in a sense, was not really the target of your comments. So the superstructure is going to be the observation that there is some, in your term, wrong-making feature that has to do with the way that you reach the determination to use defensive force, that is a significant moral component, that there can be a defect in defensive action that is defective in this process of determination, even if it's permissible on these other three Parthenian senses, that's true for individuals and that also has consequences for war. So that I take to be the kind of superstructure of the argument. And I think if I can get to that conclusion, I'm not so worried about the particular context in which we express those thoughts. So I think it is obviously really important and may have other implications about how we spell that out. So you pushed me on, I think rightly, on the way that I use terms like fully permissible and the ambiguity in there. And so I guess there are a couple of ways that you could spell that out, although I think I need to think more about what I say and what I ought to say. So one way of thinking about it is the one that you suggested, which is, I guess, a kind of Thomist view, right? So this kind of Thomist idea is that an action is
is right in the full sense when it's right not only in fact, but also in intention, and then also Parfit would add in light of the evidence, and I would add in terms in light of the process of determination. So you might say in that sense, well, it's fully permissible when it ticks off on each of those, and it's not fully permissible when it fails, when it's impermissible in one of those senses. I'm not sure that's the best way to understand what we're aiming at here. It seems to me that the real payoff, what we should really be worried about, is how should we act and orient our action in such a way that that action is not culpable. And of course, to be not culpable doesn't imply that your act is permissible in each of those senses, right? So your act could be fact, relative, and permissible, but still not culpable if it was belief and evidence, relative, permissible, for example. And equally, something can be fact, relative, permissible, but still culpable if it's negligent, reckless, and so forth. So I think that my sense is that's probably the concept that we should be aiming at, that sense of it's not culpable, that's the sense. And then, what I think is attractive about this framework is that it helps us to unpack and understand that in a much more sophisticated way. So now I guess, the question is, if there's something right in that observation that there is something important, morally important, about paying attention not only to the fact, evidence, and belief relative permissibility of the act, but also to the process by which that determination to act has been affected, what's the best way to describe that or to theorize that? And so, my solution is to essentially tack another element onto this essentially Parfitian concept, which is to say it's another aspect of the act. And you said, well, but why should we do that? Why shouldn't we say it's not an element of the act, it's some fault in either the virtue or the process of the agent, and then we characterize it in that way. Suzanne actually had a very similar set of worries in an exchange that we had earlier. So I just don't know about that. I'm not sure, and I think I need to think more about that. I mean, I guess my kind of meta position is I'm not kind of dogmatically committed to either way of doing it. I'm willing to be very pragmatic on that, if we do think that there's something to the observation. So, very happy also to take thoughts from the audience on that. Finally, so just on the kind of last, I guess doubts about the practical import. So you point out, so clearly there could be risks to waiting for the determination of an authority. So that's clearly right. So one interesting thought experiment to think about would be to say, what if there was a riskless form of authority? So let's say for example that Google has developed an authority app, right, self-defense authority app. It sits on your phone, it relies on, distributed sensors and kind of very complex algorithms, and it can instantaneously, because it's watching all the CCTV cameras in the UK, there's tons of them, and it can instantly give you a determination as to whether it's permissible to act in self-defense. If it's okay, it goes bing, if it's not okay, it goes meh. And so you just need to listen to what the phone says, and it's super reliable. So, a couple of things. First of all, if you have Authority app, you ought to use Authority app, and your app would be wrong if you don't, even if it turns out that it's fact, evidence, and so forth, relative, permissible. Secondly, I think that we have some moral reason to maybe not produce Google Authority app, but to find creative solutions in the same way that we did, presumably, in the development of legal systems when we developed authoritative torts and criminal law systems to solve that problem, which I think is I think the problem that we're solving there is not just the Lockean coordination problem, but we're solving a genuine deontological form of wrongdoing, which is that we do something wrong when we determine in a non-optimally reliable way, even if it's fact, evidence, and so forth, relative right. And then the final solution is, given we don't have Google app, given that there are these risks, I think what we sometimes need to say then is that it could sometimes be permissible on lesser evil grounds to proceed with a defensive action when we don't have the opportunity to revert to a truly authoritative body. But what's going on there is it's simply a lesser evil justification for engaging in an act that is, to some extent, again, my fully problem here, to some extent, wrong or impermissible.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, Michael, you start.